Chair and panel, Mr. O'Donnell and I represent 27 core participants who suffered abuse in Roman Catholic institutions and a campaigner, Jonathan West. Seven of our clients suffered abuse at St. Benedict's, and you will hear from some of them this week, directly or through their statements being read. Chair, behind their evidence lies considerable bravery and tenacity. Our clients who have disclosed abuse at St. Benedict's have had to surmount many hurdles. Most come from families where the first principle instilled from an early age was unquestioning loyalty and obedience to the Catholic Church, and the belief that to challenge the Church in any way was literally to invite eternal damnation. Moreover, for children who went to St. Benedict's, the institution was far more than a school. It was the centre of a complex web of family, church, and community ties. To speak out against abuse in this environment meant, for many, taking on not simply a school, but an entire upbringing, culture, and way of life in which the victim has grown up. This requires a special kind of courage. An example is our client, RCA6. As you've heard, he was a victim of David Pearce. He tried to complain about the abuse to Abbot Shipley in 2004. In 2006, with other avenues of redress exhausted, he brought a successful civil claim against the school. It was fought all the way to trial, and as you've heard, it resulted in a damning judicial indictment of both the school and Pearce. Our client's statement describes the gross failure of the school and Abbey to listen to the reality he was exposing, but it also describes the hostility, sadly, he encountered from his family for simply trying to tell his story. Sadly, his experience is that of many survivors at this school, and that reality, of course, has to inform the safeguarding response. So whilst many abusers at St. Benedict's have now been convicted in the criminal courts, it is misleading to talk about closure. The harm caused by this abuse is profound and permanent. To prevent it in the future means putting in place mechanisms which can overcome the almost overwhelming pressures of institution, religion, and culture which cause abuse to be covered up and for survivors to be disparaged and ignored. This requires an appreciation both of the depth of the problem and the radical changes needed to deal with it. With that in mind, Chair, at this stage, I simply want to highlight the matters which we believe merit particular attention in this hearing. These are the length of time over which the abuse was known about at this school, the means by which it was covered up, the inadequacy, in our view, of the school and the Benedictine response, including the Carlisle report and the visitation, and finally, but also crucially important, the failures of regulatory agencies. Turning to the first of those, the most salient fact which arises from the documents disclosed for this hearing is the extraordinary length of time over which abuse was known about in this school and was allowed to occur by senior figures in the school and the Abbey. As Kate Ravenscroft, who taught at the school from 1990, says, it was common knowledge amongst the staff that there were rumours about David Pearce. But most revealing on this point are the handwritten notes taken by the then Abbot President of the Benedictines, Richard Yeo, of his interviews with monks during his so-called extraordinary visitation in June 2010. One monk is recorded as saying, and I quote, mid-70s, new David engaged in dubious activities. Another monk, knew since I was junior school head that there was something wrong, graffiti, Father David is bent. Another of Richard Yeo's interviewees is noted as talking about rumours of abuse when he arrived 25 years previously and expressing his disappointment and disbelief that a former abbot claimed to Yeo that he, quote, never knew anything about it. So it is clear that there was extensive knowledge of David Pearce's behaviour going back to the 1980s and probably before. In our view, institutional tolerance of this behaviour is a clear signal to other abusers. Come here and we will turn a blind eye to your activities. So it seems to us likely that the failure to act on knowledge or suspicion of one abuser turns St. Benedict's into a honeypot for others. We also learn from the documents how those who might have been minded to challenge the abuse were dissuaded from doing so. Kate Ravenscroft's evidence illustrates the use of religion to keep people in line. She describes discussing an alleged abuser with Mr. Clough. Mr. Clough told her, "You can rest assured he will seek absolution for his sins." As she says, I honestly believe that Mr. Clough, as a fervently religious man, would only have been able to see the good in the priests and struggled with any knowledge that questioned this. So yet again, as elsewhere in this Catholic Church investigation, we see the cognitive dissonance which lies at the heart of the clerical abuse scandals. a priest must be a good man. He couldn't possibly be responsible for such crimes. Or once the evidence is irrefutable, the offence is put down to a momentary and forgivable lapse blamed in part on the victim. However, the evidence also shows that the cover-up at St Benedict's had a darker side still. The fact is that the staff were deterred from complaining by threats and intimidation. As one teacher says, and I quote, "At the time, the school felt a bit like the mafia. If anybody complained or said anything about Pierce, Lawrence Soper would protect him, and to complain meant putting your job on the line." And we find that word, mafia, in the descriptions of other teachers who worked at this school. As one says, "I made complaints about both Pierce and Maestri, but they didn't go anywhere and it definitely harmed my career. At times it felt like the mafia. When Clough became head, I attempted to make him aware of past issues with Pierce and others. He did not welcome this. And indeed, when Pierce went to trial, he asked the staff to pray for him. Another member of staff was so concerned about Pierce's behaviour that she contacted the headmaster. He told her, 'If you know what's good for you, keep your head down and do your job.' It seems that St Benedict's was an institution which actively suppressed dissent, which demanded groupthink, and which placed loyalty to the monks well above the protection of children." I now turn to the formal response of the school and the Abbey and the wider Benedictine congregation to this scandal. One part of it was something we have become wearily familiar with throughout the worldwide Catholic abuse scandal, the attempt to claim that anyone who criticises the Church is part of an anti-Catholic plot. We saw this in the Birmingham hearing when the Cardinal tried to suggest that a BBC programme was motivated by anti-Catholic bias. And we see it here with Mr Clough using his speech at the School Prize Day in September 2010 to insinuate that Jonathan West and others who were challenging the school's record on child protection were, and I quote, "part of an anti-Catholic movement linked to the papal visit." It seems that this claim is sometimes genuinely believed by those making it. Internal church correspondence contains frequent speculation as to what Mr West really wanted. In fact, his aims were openly stated: to assure the safety of pupils at the school his own son had attended. And when, after 4 years, he secured the school safeguarding policy he wanted, he ceased active campaigning about the school. We hope that when you write your report, you will scotch forever the absurd and self-serving notion that criticism of abuse and cover-up in the Catholic Church must be motivated by anti-Catholic prejudice. However, if we turn to the main pillars of the Church response to this scandal, commissioning the Visitation and the Carlisle Report, we can see from the disclosure that they were in reality inadequate, wholly inadequate. The Apostolic Visitation is a case study in the inherent unworkability of self-policing. Here was Richard Yeo investigating on behalf of the Vatican the advisability of having kept Pierce at the Abbey on restricted ministry. Yet this was exactly what Yeo had done as Abbot of Downside, allowing Father White to remain there even though he had admitted to abusing boys at the school. Earlier, I referred you to Richard Yeo's handwritten notes of his interviews with monks in an earlier visitation and how they disclose long-standing institutional knowledge of abuse. It speaks volumes about the purpose of the various visitations that this crucially important evidence was not disclosed to the statutory authorities. This was from a member of the Cumberledge Commission. If Richard Yeo himself didn't take the Cumberledge recommendations seriously, we can hardly expect better from anyone in the Church. As for the Carlisle report, we say that the reality is that it could never be properly impartial and independent. In saying this, we don't mean in any way to impugn the integrity of Lord Carlisle. But we do say that the documents disclosed in this hearing bear out the long-standing concerns of our client about the clients about the nature of the exercise in which Lord Carlisle was engaged and the conflicts inherent in his role. An email to Lord Carlisle from the Abbey suggested that his appointment would be, quote-unquote, advantageous to the Abbey. The Carlisle report was commissioned by the solicitor who was representing the school and the Abbey, but who was at the same time representing David Pierce and Lawrence Soper in criminal matters. We read that in the aftermath of the publicity surrounding the apostolic visitation, Lord Carlisle was giving Richard Yeo advice on public relations. These exchanges suggest that good PR for the Abbey was an inherent part of what Lord Carlisle was engaged to do, and that his inquiry cannot therefore be regarded as a dispassionate search for the truth. Lord Carlisle himself stated in a meeting with school staff that it was, quote, not his mission to rake over old coals, but to produce a document that offered reassurance as to the future of the school. In addition, we fear Lord Carlisle may have been misled. Kate Ravenscroft tells of her surprise that when the Carlisle report was commissioned, she was not selected by the school as one of the staff who should be interviewed by Lord Carlisle. That was surprising because she was the staff member who had first reported David Pearce to the police. However, our primary complaint about the Carlisle report is one of substance, that its focus was mainly on governance, not on getting in place a satisfactory child protection policy. Governance, of course, is very important. But as Jonathan West argued over many years, the most important change required was to put in place a child protection policy at the school which left no wriggle room to staff in terms of reporting reasonable suspicions of child abuse to the statutory authorities. The policy introduced in November 2011 and endorsed by Lord Carlisle signally failed to do that. It also failed to understand the institutional and personal pressures on victims not to report abuse. It suggested, for example, that an allegation of abuse might not be forwarded to the statutory authorities if the victim's family were opposed to this. I hope you can see from the evidence I cited earlier why that is such a serious flaw. It took a further 2 years and more stalling by the school before a policy was introduced that left no room for ambiguity about the external reporting obligation. As Jonathan West said, the right policy could have been put in place in 4 weeks rather than 4 years. It should have been done in 4 weeks. The fact that it eventually happened is a tribute to the efforts of campaigners. The fact that it took 4 years and was never suggested either by the Carlisle report or by the visitation confirms, in our view, the inadequacy of both and the inherent unsuitability of self-policing. Chair, I want to finish by briefly addressing the role of the regulatory agencies, the Charities Commission, the Independent Schools Inspectorate and the Department for Education. Firstly, the Charities Commission. This will be a matter to be explored in evidence later this week, but one document in the disclosure causes us some concern. This is the letter from the Charities Commission to the Abbey following the arrest of Father Pearce. The letter talks, and I quote, about the reputational risks to the charity as a result of Father Pearce's arrest. Now, of course, charities should be concerned about reputational risk, but the implication of this letter is that had the abuse not been discovered and the arrest not happened, then the reputational risk would not have arisen. The letter, in our view, fails to distinguish between immediate and underlying causes of reputational damage, the underlying cause being the safeguarding failures of the charity and the harm suffered by its beneficiaries, whilst the immediate cause is the publicity that arises when these failures come to light. The letter appears to concentrate solely on the immediate cause, Father Pearce's arrest. Since the Charities Commission, in our view, should reasonably have suspected that the extent of abuse was greater than publicly known, in our view, this letter comes perilously close to being advice to ensure that abuse not yet disclosed be covered up. I'm sure the Charities Commission will say that this isn't what they meant, but in our view, it could easily be read in that way. As regards the Independent Schools Inspectorate, the recently disclosed documents from ISI make it clear that at the time of the November 2009 inspection, it was in possession of only limited safeguarding information about the school, and that as a result, the inspection was carried out largely blind. Nonetheless, the lead inspector concluded that particular attention needed to be paid to safeguarding in its 2009 inspection. Despite this, the ISI failed to notice serious shortcomings in the school's safeguarding policy. They were only reported on the following year, having been pointed out to the ISI by Mr. West. Since the ISI is the inspecting body for the great majority of independent schools, we say that these failures have a potential significance far beyond this particular case study. Turning finally, Chair, to the Department for Education, Penny Jones's statement contains a remarkable and shocking series of disclosures. It confirms that the Department for Education knew nothing about failings at the school until alerted by Mr. West, despite the criminal convictions of Pearce and Maestri. It makes clear the complete helplessness of the Department for Education in the face of an independent school which does not prioritise safeguarding. As Penny Jones says, the difficulty for the Department for Education and ministers was that there were no clear regulations covering governance, management and leadership of the school. The Department for Education was so helpless that the school's minister, Nick Gibb MP, wrote to the head of the Charities Commission asking for assistance in getting RC F41, who by that time was on list 99, moved from the monastery. Again, since the Department for Education is the regulator for the entire educational sector, including all independent schools, Catholic or otherwise, it is clear that these issues have a significance far beyond the confines of this case study, and we urge you, Chair, to ensure that these are explored at a later hearing. Chair, even before we hear this week's evidence, it is obvious that St Benedict's and the Catholic Church around it was wholly incapable of ensuring safeguarding responsibly by itself. As we've long argued, that means that mandatory reporting is essential, and indeed this case study demonstrates precisely the need for mandatory reporting given the length of time, particularly over which abuse persisted in this school without action being taken. But of course, mandatory reporting can only work if the agencies to whom the reporting is done are using that information effectively. So that needs to happen. Chair, those are our initial observations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scorer.